The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gabe. I work here, and I want to introduce my friend Jane Ryer, who's going to be our guest speaker tonight. She's already guided us through a lovely meditation. Just a few important things about Jane. Jane's a longtime, really dedicated practitioner. She spent about 6 years, four of which at a Zen monastery, Tassajara in California, but 6 years practicing intensely. She does regular long retreats, and she's also an environmental activist, and I think she'll probably talk more about both of those themes. So thanks so much for being here, Jane.
Thank you. Actually, I'm not going to really talk about the, the environmental activism part in particular. You know, I took the title of my talk tonight is For the One Heart of the World. And I realized that there might be people here who don't get the reference. It's from the phrase One Heart of the World is from a grace that we often say here at Common Ground when we're eating a meal together. And so I just wanted to read it to you so that everybody kind of, you know, knows what I meant when I used that phrase. It's written by Norman Fisher, who is a former co-abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, which is the center that Tassajara is a part of. So it was nice for me. It was kind of like coming home to see that we use this grace sometimes. It's called the One Heart Grace. As we make ready to eat this food, we remember with gratitude the people, animals, plants, insects, creatures of the sky and sea, air and water, fire and earth, all turning in the wheel of living and dying, whose joyful exertion, not separate from ours, provide our sustenance this day. May we, with the blessing of this food, join our hearts to the one heart of the world in awareness and love. And may we together with everyone realize the path of awakening and never stop making effort for the benefit of others. So what Mark suggested that I talk about tonight, I think he said something about, this is from Gabe, I actually got this from Gabe, but I assume Mark also said something similar, the intersection of practice and activism, and finding a balance between seclusion or intensive meditation practice and engagement in the world. You know, I've noticed in a lot of conversations that I've had with a lot of people that there seems to kind of be a sense that sitting in meditation is something that we do in order to become better people so that we can be of more benefit to others in our lives and in our interactions with other people. Even at Tassajara, it seems like virtually all of us assumed that our temporary withdrawal from the world would one day blossom into sort of the real work that, with the benefit of helping other people through our engagement with the world. But I've really come to think that sort of the flip side of that is more the reality that my, at least, you know, looking at myself and my life and how I feel about practice, my sitting practice, the practice itself, is for the benefit of the whole universe. And, you know, my engagement in the world is more about what I do in order to not go crazy from sitting too much. You know, it's true that during my years in the monastery, I kept leaving off and on to come back to the Midwest to work on. I mostly fight the, you know, mining industry. That's sort of what I do for a living. And I'd come back for one battle or another. But, you know, I didn't really necessarily, I really didn't come back because I felt that it was more important for me to be doing that work. You know, I would say I came back when psychologically or or for whatever reason, I just wasn't able to keep sitting as intensively as I was. It wasn't about kind of having a judgment that that sitting and doing that intensive practice wasn't of itself work for the world, of benefit to the world. It was more just that I'm a human being, and I think like all human beings, we human beings do things, you know. That's the way we are. That's the way our species is. I don't really think that there's, if you're like me, there's really not a danger of not being active and not doing anything in the world, because it's just the way human beings are. And I've really noticed that also at the monasteries and hermitages that I've been at, the monks and nuns, they're all doing things, you know. They, they're not just sitting, and it's not because they don't, you know, think that just sitting is a good idea. It's really because they're human beings, and human beings as a species, you know, we do things. That might be part of what the problem is in the world. We do too much. So I really want to start out this talk, and actually most of my talk is going to be about how and why I think that Buddhist meditation practice is really in and of itself of benefit to the whole of the universe. And I would say that even more strongly. I think that having a dedicated, consistent, lifelong meditation practice is really actually the best thing that we can do for the world. So I'm going to talk about this on a couple of different levels. Later in my talk, I'll talk about the impact of our practice on what in Buddhism is often referred to as the immaterial plane. And I think you can think of that as in the spiritual plane or in the realm of mind or consciousness. So that the impact that the practice has in that sort of spiritual realm. But I'm going to start out by talking about really what I see as the ultimate value of Buddhist practice, even within the material world as we interact with each other. So my thinking about this has been influenced by an article by Margaret Wheatley that I read in the course of my work, actually, for the National Wildlife Federation when I worked there about 20 years ago. The question that Wheatley was addressing in this article was, at what level do we work most effectively to make changes in the world as activists? One example of this question is maybe within the realm of immigration. Do we work? Is it, you know, more effective? Is our time better spent helping local immigrants who are maybe in danger of being deported or something here in our own community? Or do we put, we have limited resources, limited time, do we put those time and resources into trying to change the policy of the country that we're living in? Or do we put that time and resources into changing things on a global level so that people aren't in those situations where they need to leave their countries due to violence or poverty, famine? Which of those is really the most helpful? And what Wheatley pointed out was that at each step, you know, to a sort of a deeper level, the task becomes significantly more difficult. It's easier to help one person who's in danger of being deported than it is to change, you know, the war situation in Syria or something like that. But yet, the changes that we're able to make at the deepest level are the most effective changes. And so I think that her conclusion really in that was, you know, to work where it's most comfortable. There is no right answer to that. But what I want to say tonight is it's not always immediately apparent, I think, what a deeper level is. In the example that I gave, it was sort of as you go up to a more worldwide, more global situation, is sort of going to a deeper level. And so we might think of work that actually changes ourselves and changes our own minds, our motivations and our ways of being in the world, that might not seem to be a deep level of change. But I don't think that's true. I would disagree with that. I really believe that changing human hearts and minds is the deepest level of change that there is. Because everything, the whole world situation, everything that's happening in the world that we're so concerned about really arises out of our human minds and hearts and what's actually going on inside of us. And the only possible place that we have to change human hearts and minds really is within our own hearts and minds. I think it's important to remember as we listen to the news and as we react to the things that we hear, the things that are going on in the world, and particularly here in the United States, that all of the violence and intolerance, the dishonesty, the lack of concern for the suffering of other beings, these things are all, they aren't the disease itself. They're symptoms of the disease. You know, our current elected officials or even the general malaise that got those officials elected, they really aren't the fundamental problem. The actual disease that gives rise to all of this is the fundamental human state of delusion and the greed and hate that are never far behind. While it may be true that this earth and the human species go through cycles of better times and worse times, more suffering, less suffering, causing each other more grief or less grief. The worst times always come around again, and as long as the fundamental delusion of the human mind continues, they will continue. The bad times will continue to come around. And that's not to say that that it's not sometimes really imperative that we do treat the symptoms. Symptoms sometimes can threaten a patient's life in and of themselves. And you know, I'm an environmentalist, so the example that I would use is global warming. Of course, it's like the Earth has a fever, you know, quite literally. We're suffering from this fever, and we really don't know what the extent of the damage will be if we don't bring that fever down. But I guess that what I wanted to say to you here tonight is that the need to bring the fever down doesn't lessen the importance of continuing to treat the disease itself. And that's what we're doing in meditation. While we are asking ourselves what we can do to address all of the injustices and the dangerous policies that are guiding current governments, let's continue to ask ourselves what we can do to address human delusion and the resulting greed and hate out of which all these painful things arise. So for those of us who don't believe or are agnostic about reincarnation, I think addressing the disease of human delusion can sometimes seem like an overwhelming task. Like, you know, sometimes it can feel like I'm never, ever going to reach. I am not going to reach the end of my own delusion by the time I die, you know. Sometimes it you know, really seems that way. And I, you know, I think that it is easier for people who, you know, have this belief that they're going to come back in future lifetimes and that that the work that they do here will stay with them into the next lifetime. That maybe makes it easier to see, to believe that that the whole sort of project is really of value. I'm pretty agnostic about reincarnation myself. But one of the things that I wanted to say is that the Buddha, he really emphasized again and again that this is a gradual path, that it's not an all or nothing path. It's not like you start out, it's not like you're deluded and you're at this level of delusion and it's all the same until one day, snap, you know, you're enlightened and you're not deluded anymore. It's really not like that. It's really a gradual process of less and of lessening your delusion as you go through your practice and as your life goes on. And I really think that even on a sort of the level of ordinary life, we can probably all think of people in our lives who really made a difference to us, who really changed the way we are in the world because of their kindness or their compassion, their generosity. And hopefully we can also see in our own lives. I know a lot of times people say that it's hard to see the fruits of meditation yourself, but the people who are close to you can see them. It's like a lot of times partners, spouses, or even, you know, children can really notice that, wow, you know, you're treating me a little better since you started meditating. So those impacts, I think we can understand that they can affect not just the people around us in our lives, but that they really can extend through the generations. Because, of course, the way we treat children and people who are coming up who are younger than we are does influence the amount of greed, hate, and delusion in the world. So that's sort of the view of the importance of our practice in our ordinary view of the world. But I really do think that there's something else going on. And it's something that's a lot more difficult to see. I'm going to try to get at it tonight. I'm not sure how articulate I'll be about it. But it's really difficult to understand with our ordinary ways of thinking. So anyway, I hope you'll bear with me. When I lived up in Grand Marais before I went off to Tassajara, in I think it was 2006 that I left. But anyway, my partner and I, her niece and nephew came to live with us. They were with us kind of off and on for about 3 years. And her nephew was it was between the time that he was maybe 6 and 8, and his sister was a couple years older. So I was a member. I had a little sitting group up there, and we had a yurt on our property. The sitting group met in our yurt, and Tom, our nephew, he sat with us. It was amazing to me. I always told him, he was only 7 years old when he started sitting with us, and I always told him, you know, an hour-long sit for a seven-year-old is pretty amazing. And then he'd really like to listen to our talk, you know, our discussion afterwards as well. So one day I was listening to him and his sister have a talk about religion. They were in another room. I don't think they knew I was listening. And his sister said, I'm not a Buddhist. I don't want to be a Buddhist because Buddhists believe we don't have souls. And I have a soul. I was kind of impressed that she understood as much as she did at that point. But Tom says, well, it's not really that we don't have souls. It's just that we all have the same soul. We just have one soul, you know. So, and, you know, I want to say that I don't really think that that's, I'm not saying that that's the Buddhist understanding of things. That's not what I'm trying to say here. But it does seem to me that it's sort of a, you know, it gets at something that I think is implicit in the Buddha's teaching, and that is, you know, just simply that we are all connected on a spiritual level in a way that we absolutely cannot fathom. We just don't understand it. But that doesn't mean that it isn't there. I think most of us can kind of understand something similar, and probably mostly because of Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, and his teaching. We've been really fortunate in our lifetimes to be on the planet with this great teacher. And I think I'm going to read one of his essays that is probably one of his most well-known essays, and I think probably a lot of people have heard it before, but it's, you know, we probably can't hear it too often. If you are a poet, you will see clearly that there is a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there will be no rain. Without rain, the trees cannot grow. And without trees, we cannot make paper. The cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not here, the sheet of paper cannot be here either. So we can say that the cloud and the paper inter are. Interbeing is a word that is not in the dictionary yet, but if we combine the prefix inter with the verb to be, we have a new verb, interbe. If we look into this sheet of paper even more deeply, we can see the sunshine in it. Without sunshine, the forest cannot grow. In fact, nothing can grow without sunshine. And so we know that the sunshine is also in this sheet of paper. The paper and the sunshine inter are. And if we continue to look, we can see the logger who cut the tree and brought it to the mill to be transformed into paper. And we see wheat. We know that the logger cannot exist without his daily bread, and therefore the wheat that becomes his bread is also in this sheet of paper. The logger's father and mother are in it too. When we look in this way, we see that without all of these things, this sheet of paper cannot exist. Looking even more deeply, we can see ourselves in this sheet of paper too. This is not difficult to see, because when we look at a sheet of paper, it is part of our perception. Your mind is in here, and mine is also. So we can say that everything is in here with this sheet of paper. We cannot point out one thing that is not here. Time, space, the earth, the rain, the minerals in the soil, the sunshine, the cloud, the river, the heat. Everything coexists with this sheet of paper. That is why I think the word interbe should be in the dictionary. To be is to interbe. We cannot just be by ourselves alone. We have to interbe with every other thing. This sheet of paper is because everything else is. Suppose we try to return one of the elements to its source. Suppose we return the sunshine to the sun. Do you think that this sheet of paper will be possible? No, without sunshine, nothing can be. And if we return the logger to his mother, then we have no sheet of paper either. The fact is that this sheet of paper is made up only of non-paper elements. And if we return those non-paper elements to their sources, then there can be no paper at all. Without non-paper elements, like mind, logger, sunshine, and so on, there will be no paper. As thin as this sheet of paper is, it contains everything in the universe in it.
What's his name?
Thich Nhat Hanh.
Oh.
So one of the ways that I like to sort of bring this home to myself is to think about, I'm just fascinated by the fact that there is not an atom or a molecule in this body other than my teeth that was actually in this body 7 years ago. You know? Not a single bit of matter, except for my teeth, and actually, you know, there's no matter of any kind that's in this body that was there when I was born. So from there, I like to think about, well, what, you know, all of the matter, every molecule, every atom in this body was part of the greater world 7 years ago or less. So you know, for instance, what that means is that all of us drink water. You know, here in the Twin Cities, it means that the Mississippi River is flowing in our veins. And we're literally made of the soil, the nutrients in the soil from California and Florida and Mexico, as well as from Wisconsin and Minnesota. We're made of sunlight through the unfathomable mystery of photosynthesis. And we can't even imagine where the oxygen that's in our body right now, all of the places that it has been, you know, before it's been a part of our body, our bodies. So science really allows us to understand this about the physical world and about our physical bodies. It's kind of counterintuitive. We feel like this body is like the same body we had 10 years ago. And it really, without science to understand this, it's probably something that we wouldn't understand. And we really don't have a similar way of understanding how the whole universe flows in and out of us on a spiritual level. And so I think that because we don't have that way of understanding things on a spiritual level, we're more apt to sort of hold on to the belief that on the level of mind or consciousness or spirit, you know, whatever word you want to use, we are discrete, self-contained entities. And I think, you know, we sort of have that sense. But if you really think about how things are on a material level, what we know about the flow of the universe through our bodies on a material level, it seems really unlikely to me that that something similar isn't true on a spiritual level. So I hope that, you know, everyone will at least entertain the possibility that your spiritual practice really reaches everyone and everything, that it reaches the one heart of the world in some way that you simply aren't able to understand or experience in our ordinary capacity in the world. So the Buddha himself said many times that this spiritual practice is the most valuable undertaking that there is for any being, and that actually the supreme benefit of being born a human being is that it gives us the opportunity to take up this practice. As far as the Buddha was concerned, it was much better to be born a human with all of the sufferings of a human being than it was to be born, you know, in the Dewa realm, in the heavens, in a life of immaterial plane where you didn't have to worry about any of the problems that come with having a physical body. As far as the Buddha was concerned, it was better to be born as a human being because it gave us the opportunity to take up this practice. And that was the greatest thing that a being could do. I think that sometimes the Buddha's teachings are misinterpreted as being focused on a selfish end, which would be sort of liberating this individual being from the suffering that it experiences. But I think that that idea arises because the Buddha was such a practical teacher. Rather than trying to explain the unexplainable, he taught the means for people to see things for themselves. And his teaching really included finding the motivation to follow this path. He needed to find a motivation that worked for deluded beings, because as we practice, as we take up the practice, we're deluded beings. You know, it's not, that's just the way we are. It's not like it's a criticism of human beings or anything like that. But we do need a motivation that works despite the fact that we really can't see what's actually going on in the world. Of course, practicing for the sake of all beings is a beautiful motivation, and in the Mahayana traditions, that's explicitly used. In Zen and some of the other Mahayana sects, you're really encouraged to find the motivation of practicing for the sake of all beings as your motivation. But I think, you know, some of us, we don't always feel a universal oneness with all beings, you know, especially not on a daily basis. And we're often tired and cranky, and, you know, the kids are screaming, we've had a bad day at work. And sometimes, you know, the one heart of the world just isn't that accessible to us. And yet we can always connect with our own suffering. And so I think that that was why the Buddha offered sort of a self-centered motivation, that the end of that we can sit, you know, that we can find the motivation to sit in the hope that we will alleviate our own suffering. But that doesn't make that motivation the whole story of, you know, of what's going on in the whole of reality. The Buddha was accused many times in his own lifetime of being nihilistic. I think that was probably the objection to his teaching that was leveled at him the most, and he always insisted that he was not. The Buddha had kind of, he ran into some difficulties because he refused to sort of explain to people or come up with a description of, you know, of how he saw reality, because he found it to be impossible to express. And so instead he would just, you know, keep saying that it's not this and it's not this and it's not this. And that was sometimes interpreted as sort of leading to the point of being nihilistic. But I just don't believe that that the Buddha, and I don't believe that the Buddha thought that the highest goal for a human being was simply to escape the misery of human existence, which I think is what he was being accused of at the time. This is one of my favorite quotes from the Buddha. I mean, maybe I'm just saying it to you because I love to tell people this. This is one of his teachings. It is in this way that we must train ourselves. By liberation of the self through love, we will develop love, we will practice it, we will make it both a way and a basis, take our stand upon it, store it up, and thoroughly set it going. The Buddha consistently told his followers to repay cruelty with kindness, to have no enmity toward anyone, no matter what they had done. And even as he was dying of food poisoning, his concern was for the person who had served him the spoiled food, that person, he sent a messenger, actually, to make sure that that person didn't feel badly about what had happened. So when I think of a teacher who, you know, these are the sorts of things he teaches, the way he teaches, and the encouragements that he gives to his followers, it's just impossible for me to believe that he actually thought that that the highest use of a human life was to escape our suffering in the end. And so I guess it's not explicit in his teaching necessarily, but it just seems to me that that if this practice is, you know, the best use of a human life, there has to be something really mysterious and amazing going on that we really aren't capable of of understanding with our deluded minds. Let's see, what time is it?
Could you read that passage?
Yeah, It is in this way we must train ourselves. By liberation of the self through love, we will develop love, we will practice it, we will make it both a way and a basis, take our stand upon it, store it up, and thoroughly set it going. So sometimes when I'm, gathering up the gumption to go back to the monastery or to go on a long retreat, I encourage myself by thinking about the Buddha, and he really encouraged people to spend a lot of time in practice. And I think about how there was a prophecy at his birth that he would either be a wheel-turning monarch or a great spiritual teacher. And sometimes I think that if he were born today, and we heard that prophecy, a lot of us would say, oh, well, of course he has to become a wheel-turning monarch, because we really need a wheel-turning monarch. And to tell you a little bit more about what a wheel-turning monarch is, it's a king, is all men in those days, so I guess I'll just use those pronouns. A monarch who ruled with such peaceful means and with such justice and such concern for everybody, from the people at the most prestigious people down to, one passage says, the beasts and the birds. A monarch who makes sure that everybody and every being is cared for, and who consults with people who really understand the Dhamma and who know what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, and listens to those people and acts accordingly in his governance of the world, so that everybody, all of the nations in the world, want to be under his rule, because people who live under his rule have such a good life, and everything's wonderful for everybody. And, we're all here in this state that our world is in today and that our country is in. And, a wheel-turning monarch sounds really good, And I just wonder, I just think how many of us, would feel like, well, that's the thing to do, to be a wheel-turning monarch. And yet, when you think about it, we really revere the Buddha. A lot of the reason is because he didn't become a wheel-turning monarch. He took up the spiritual life, and that's what he did, and became, what to me is the greatest spiritual teacher of our time, of our long era. And so I guess I just, that says something to me. I also think it's interesting to consider what we would have thought of Siddhartha Gautama if we met him before his Great Awakening, if that's when he was introduced to us. I think from the standpoint of our own cultural values, we would have found him, to be primarily a failure. He failed at being a husband and a father, and he failed at being a good son. He didn't take up the livelihood that he had been trained for since the time he was a child. He had practiced with accomplished teachers, but he just kept leaving them. I've told my teachers that a few times. And then he failed at living as an ascetic. And so the question I think that is interesting is, did his enlightenment somehow vindicate all of the things, all of that long list of ways in which he, you know, he wasn't good enough, I guess, that he had failed in some way. And I don't think that that's the case. I think that all of that time that that he was going through all of those experiences and doing all those things, he was a bodhisattva. He was a being in the process of becoming a Buddha. And this is something else, I think, from the Mahayana tradition that might be helpful to people, to us, is seeing ourselves as, in the Mahayana tradition, treats all Buddha's practitioners as bodhisattvas, as, you know, as people in the process of becoming Buddhas. And I find that helpful for myself when I, you know, get to the point where I'm like, you know, is this of any value? What am I doing? This, I should be out working in the world. I should be doing more for the world. To remember to see myself as a being in the process of becoming a Buddha. So I just want to, I'm going to skip a couple of things because I do want to say that that I just want to acknowledge how hard practice is. And I really understand that a lot of times it can seem like really not, you know, not like the most valuable thing that you can do with your life. You can be in the middle of a sit or in the middle of a retreat and really feel like, you know, this is not of any use to anybody. And I really, for like the first 10 years, I would say, of my really serious practice, I became really serious about practice, I would say, in about 2001. And for the first 10 years, every time I did a retreat, I noticed a pattern day four. I hated it when the teachers would always say, oh, it's day four, now our minds are calming down. Like, whose mind is calming down? You know, I always found that on day four, I got to the point where I just couldn't stand it anymore. And I would start, really the thoughts would start up, this is a waste of time. And I could be doing something for people. I could be, you know, I could be making much better use of this week helping people somewhere than sitting here, you know, spinning around in my thoughts you know, just feeling like I'm going to scream if I sit here one more minute. So I've been there, and, you know, I really understand that feeling. But I came finally to really understand that I was suffering from two of the hindrances. That one of the lists in Buddhism is full of lists, and one of them is the five hindrances. And I think that there's a combination of restlessness and doubt that sort of attacks us and makes us feel like what we're doing is really not of value. And when you really think about it, it seems like what's happening is that we experience this meditation as unpleasant for whatever reason. You know, we've been sitting there too long. We're human beings. We like to do things. We're not doing anything. And it becomes unpleasant. And so this organism starts sort of casting around for a way out of this situation. What am I going to do to get myself out of this? You know? And what seems to work pretty well is to have thoughts about how this is a waste of time, this isn't doing anything, because if you sit there thinking that long enough, oftentimes you will just get up and, you know, stop sitting. And so then the next time this organism knows that having this thought, these thoughts might get it out of the predicament it's in, the unpleasantness that it's experiencing. And so when you quit at that point, you just start reinforcing that's going to happen to you, you know, again and again. And I think that with all of the hindrances, you you have to sit through them. You have to learn. You have to, at some point in your practice, sit through them, because you're never going to go beyond them until you've really just sat with them, until they lessen or go away. And I, Mark is teaching the next Buddhist studies class on Monday nights, is on the five hindrances. So if you do have a regular practice and have some, I think the qualification is to have some retreat practice. If you haven't taken Buddhist studies course before, I would really encourage you to take the course on the five hindrances. I think it's really, really extremely valuable for learning to really be able to stick with your practice and to have a steady, ongoing practice, is to really sort of learn how to work with the hindrances. So in my experience and my estimation, I think that a lot of the tension that we feel maybe between really devoting ourselves to a spiritual practice and being engaged in the world has more to do with our reaction to some of the hindrances than it does to anything that is actually, you know, real in our lives. I do have some advice for people about balance and as far as sitting and engagement in the world. My advice is to sit as much as you can, you know, that and if you aren't sure what that, how much that is, to talk with Mark or with another teacher about what might work for you. If you find that you can sit for a half an hour or an hour a day, then do that, you know. I guess it's as much as you can sit sort of psychologically. But that doesn't mean just to sit until you want to get up and get up, or until you can't stand it anymore and then get up. It means more to really figure out, you know, what's an appropriate amount of time for you to be sitting on a daily basis as far as where you are in your practice right now. And also, what's an appropriate amount of time for you to try to do retreats? Maybe if you're new and you haven't done retreats before, to start doing the half-day sits or the one-day sits, slowly work up to going on overnight retreats, just kind of based on where you are in your practice. And I think Mark or other more experienced practitioners in the community can really help with that. And then for engagement in the world, to just do those things that you find yourself doing, you know? Rather than thinking about what you ought to be doing, or agonizing about, should I do this, should I do that, you know, to just do the things that you find yourself doing. And I think that as your practice becomes more regular and consistent and longer, you will more find yourself just doing things without, you know, all of the sort of agonizing that we tend to do over thinking about all of the things that we should be doing in the world. So to close, I just want to say just a word about the guided meditation that we did at the beginning and sort of how it relates to the topic of this talk, because in my mind it does relate, but I realize it might not to other people. I would suggest that whatever actions you take, you know, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, see if you can find a sense that those, that your actions are nothing more than being alive, that what you're doing in all of the actions you take is just being alive, that at that particular moment, be it just being alive might look like you know, marching in a climate change march or volunteering to help immigrants, calling your legislators, you know, or playing with your kids, feeding your kids, you know, whatever it is you're doing, your work, whatever, wherever you are at work, in any moment, every single moment, you can see what you're doing and what's in that moment as just being alive. And relax into that. Just remind yourself, just being alive is enough. And then you can just relax into what you're doing, and that's enough. Your aliveness is always with you, and it's the heart of every activity and every moment of rest. It's the one heart of the world where you and all of reality intersect. So we have a few minutes for questions or comments. Anybody, you know, have just an observation that they'd like to make?
And we'll use the mic so we can hear. And the talk is being recorded, just so you know.
I'm Don, and thank you so much for all of that. So I've been just lately thinking about like spirituality, and I'm not quite sure really what that is. And my observation, I'm thinking of as that passage you wrote or that was in there about to leave the self is to love others. I think that was the beginning of it.
Liberating ourselves through love.
Through love.
Through love.
And then
right.
And then that's where I kind of thought, I said, well, I think that's the beginning of spirituality for what I kind of put in with that. And then, so we do that. And then I think in the way of meditating, so I'd like to aspire to that, but then what does that look like? So I would probably get the formulation with that from, or idea from meditating, or in the process of meditating might open myself up to more liberating myself from the self to through love, I guess.
Yeah, I think that it maybe helps not to think about it too much. And, you know, both with practicing metta, loving-kindness meditation, and also in simply in our lives, really reminding ourselves to be open to each other in any, you know, any ways that we can. As we sit and as our practice continues, I have certainly found that becomes easier in my life. And so I think that those things really sort of build on each other, contribute to each other. And as far as really understanding the spiritual life, it's not something we can understand through our thinking, through our regular thinking. And I think that, I mean, this was a lot of the Buddha and his sort of practicality as a teacher of, I looked for a passage I really wanted to read to people. I didn't find it out of one of the suttas about motivation and how, you know, actually in the end, the motivation really is not what's important. What's really important is that you actually do the practice, you know? And so doing the practice over the years with diligence is really what brings us to liberation. It's not really so much the motivation. The motivation is to get us to practice.
Thanks, Jane. I'm Gabe. Just a few disparate thoughts, but One of them is just, just appreciating your encouragement of all of us to sit as much as possible. And I say that because I think, it's just such an interest. And I've had conversations, this seems to come up a lot, this kind of what you addressed, like this apparent tension between sitting, between seclusion and engagement, and how much should I sit? Oh, I feel like I've been sitting too much, avoiding my problems. And I think there's some truth to those, to those worries or in my own practice, at times I've seen that. But lately, over the years, I've been practicing now for almost a decade, and kind of some of those, it just kind of gets worked out, or you see where your intentions are, and you just come to appreciate kind of what you're saying is like what you said about just living or just being alive and having that sort of, so it's less about, the form it takes, and yet, like, sitting and practicing seems very valuable right now to me in my life, and sort of like I think some of the shadows of it, or even some of the stigma I can feel around it, like sitting a lot, is just a lot of it comes, I think, just from our culture, and like you're saying, how we just put so much value on doing, but like there's so much that happens in practice. It's so rich. It's like a whole other world, a whole other territory, unexplored territory, and yet not also then getting attached to that. I just think it's a fascinating conversation, and I really appreciated your kind of trying to not paint it in these easy black and white, and to just put out a call for the value of that, which I think even in modern Vipassana and modern meditation circles, that dichotomy can be strongly emphasized, and it can be watered down, I think, just because of the busyness of our culture. So thanks so much.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.